Thank you for joining us today. This is an In Conversation, and just to let you know a little bit about In Conversations, these are part of the Friday Gallery Talks. They start at 12:30 on Fridays. There's probably going to be about four a year, and they go a little bit more in depth. They allow us to go a little more in depth with talking to artists about their work, and they are particularly set up to talk to artists about the work. And today our artist is Neen Humphrey, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about her before we start. But the idea is to have a conversation about the work that she's been doing at the Smithsonian, and we'll go into that a little bit more later. Just to give you an idea of about Neen and her work, she's based in New York. She has received a BA from St. Mary's College in 1968, an MA from Goddard College in 72, and an MFA from York University in Toronto, Canada. She grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, and one of the things that writers, when they talk about her work, they often will talk about it as being kind of very intensive and referencing the kind of work that women do domestically, things that have to do with the handmade, working processes that artists use that are more connected to like the idea of a woman's work. So where she goes with that is really interesting with this work, I think. And her work has taken a lot of different forms. She's gone from doing abstract plaster and wax sculptures based on the interior body parts to copper and steel crown sculptures, and most recently to the installation set where she uses fabric and felt and silk. And her recent series, Small Worlds, was exhibited in Leslie Heller Gallery in New York. She continues these themes of mapping in a macro and micro scale, and she pulls imageries of cellular observations, 18th century optical diagrams, and celestial maps together in this work. Throughout her career, though, an interesting thing is that there's always been drawing. And so when we look at this work, these are long-term projects, but drawing is always a part of them. So over the last year, Neen has been a resident at the lab of Joseph Ledoux at the M. Keck Foundation Laboratory for Neurobiology at New York University. And this is a lab that's in the forefront of brain research, especially right now they're exploring how the brain mechanisms for fear and anxiety. And so that also will enter some of the content of her work, and I think that's really a very interesting thing for us to look at too. She has received a fellowship from the Rockefeller Foundation, from the National Endowment of the Arts, and she's here today with us to discuss her residency at the Smithsonian as an artist research fellow. This is a competitive fellowship that is at the Smithsonian that brings artists from all over the world together, and it brings them together as part of their practice to research the collections here. And so part of what she did here was work with the Museum of American History's collection of anatomical figures or models, and to start to look at them. And she particularly worked with a papier-mâché model of a brain made by a 19th century man named Ozu. And we'll talk about that today. I got a chance to see it earlier this week. It was really beautiful. So I'm really excited about a couple things, which is this conflation of science and art practice together, and also just the chance to talk to you more about your process in depth. So let's start with how this current project that you're working on now relates to some earlier works or some investigations you did earlier.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Yes? Good. Okay. Well, I've brought some images from earlier work that kind of dovetail into what I'm doing now. I've had a really long-term interest in the body, and I always think of it as a primary vehicle through which we explore the world, both physically and psychologically. And I think that's why I became a sculptor, because it's three-dimensional, very visceral and tactile sorts of things that I'm interested in. This is an image from a place in Florence where they have a lot of wax anatomical models, which were originally used to teach physicians about the body and how to dissect the body. And I've been, along with making art, I love to research, and I keep folders on various things that are interesting me at the time. And with anatomy, I've been interested since the 70s, when I first came to New York, in all kinds of anatomical models and images from all over the world and from all different time periods. Initially, I was interested in pre-20th century images where there were things like the microscope had not come into full use until the 19th century. The X-ray came into being at that time, and several other ways of helping us look at the human body. So the way people were looking at the body were influenced by religion in some cultures, and also by the fact that they couldn't see everything that we can see today. So a lot of it, in my mind at least, was made up, and I was interested in this sort of imaginative look at the body. Gradually, and I'm going, as Ryan said, I'm going through many, many years of work, but gradually this interest started focusing on the interior of the body, and specifically the things that we cannot see without the aid of something like a microscope or an X-ray. So looking at ourselves in a way that we can't do in any other way without some kind of aid. And this is an image from the 19th century of cellular structures. Well, that's so small. This is actually a very large piece.
So yeah, could you talk about the dimensions of the medium?
So I'm going to show you a couple of pieces that are related to this early work with specifically different kinds of cellular structures. And this piece, believe it or not, is almost 12 feet high by maybe 18 or 20 across, given the space around it, which is part of it also. This is made with large panels of industrial felt, which is a little different than the kind of felt we might think of in the craft store or that's used in fabric making sometimes. It's very, very thick, like if you think of a piano key. And felt is one of the strongest, if not strongest materials in the world. And I was using this as a surface rather than canvas or plaster or some other more traditional form of making work to work on because of it has a very sensual, tactile quality to it. It has kind of a muffling feeling because it's felt. And I love the surface. So this work is about cellular structures, and also I was looking at a lot of mapping structures, if you think of sky charts and things like that. So both the macro and micro were involved in my thinking at the time.
Can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. The darker shapes, is that the organza, or is that? Oh, there you go.
There we go. So the piece is made up of, and all of my work follows this pattern. My process is incredibly slow and very labor intensive. I work by hand with assistants. And I use drawing as kind of a way to get, as Ryan was saying, instant gratification, because these take months to develop into works of art. The process here was using small discs of felt. And as you see, they have in an abstracted way, a look that might be akin to a corpuscle. Using small discs of felt and then sewing silk organza around that. And the needle and thread that made that disc is then used to pin it to the
So each one is that's sewn is then the tool that's used for it is pinned on.
Exactly. Okay. So you in effect see the whole making process. The needle and thread is visible, as well as the little discs that were made by that needle and thread. And the composition is based on the things I was talking about earlier, looking at a lot of ways of looking at the cosmos, as well as looking at a lot of ways of looking at the interior. I've also used the color red for a long time. It's obviously a body color. It's also a very beautiful, sensual color. And also, I grew up Catholic in Wisconsin, and I have always felt that that's a part of my using red, because it's a very dominant color in Catholicism and has many levels of different meanings.
And that's interesting when we talk about the connection to the body, too. but we'll go we'll talk about it a little bit later. And this is another series of works that you've done?
And this is another series. I tend to work in long, long, long series until I feel like I've exhausted the idea. So the series you saw before was called Loculus, which is the meaning is a small kind of cavity or shape within the body. And that series went through 2 or 3 years until I finally felt like I wanted to go someplace else with the work. And where I wanted to go was even deeper inside the body than that corpuscular level. So I started looking at very high-tech ways of seeing inside the body, not just x-ray images and simple microscope images, but also electron microscopic images, which can go in levels very, very, very deep within the body. And the images were fascinating to me. And so I got very interested in neuroscience. And at a certain point, started exhausting the images. There's only so many out there. It's not the kind of thing you find many books about. So this particular piece here is about the size, the height of a lab table, and it's about 8 feet long. And on it are various steel forms, which are of these electron microscopic images. And these are all of the brain, of our brain, human brains.
Now, just to clarify, yeah. these are photographic representations that you go back into, or
right.
are they drawings that you've
right.
made from
this is
a photograph?
This is a photographic representation taken from an electron microscope. And then I print it on a piece of fabric, fool around with the color a little bit. The reason all these images are initially colored in the scientific world is so that you can see certain kinds of information. Otherwise, it would look just sort of like a gray mass. So they're colorized in different ways to see different kinds of information. And then I would go back in and use embroidery thread, sort of like you'd use a pencil, as a drawing tool, and draw into the image. And so in this way of working, I think, is where I bring my imagination into it and draw back into an image that's already made. And the forms themselves are, I think you could see, fairly small. The hoops are the size of an embroidery hoop, which is what I initially used to sew on. They're also a reference to early microscopes and a reference to those sort of cheap mirrors you see in the dime store where they're plastic and can move back and forth. So I was thinking about different kinds of lenses through which you can see things. And they're all on these simple steel stands. And then often, which is impossible to see on the slides, but they're often collaged in addition with several other layers, and then there's a piece of glass over the whole thing.
But if you flip them, you'll be able to see the other side too.
If you flip them or just walked around the table, and it's a little hard to see here, but on the far right, you can see the back of one of these.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you can use your pointer now if you want. I mean, the one over
everyone
to the...
Everyone see it without me using
the one
pointer.
The one in the right corner?
The one in the right corner. The far right corner. So these images looked, as I was finding them, literally, they're found images. I was finding them in libraries and scientific books. They're very landscape looking sometimes. They're also very map-like. And this way of looking at the body, to me, was very much about mapping, about finding your way into the body in different levels.
So are you thinking them of more representing something that is a reality, or do you look at are you using this source material to go towards abstraction, or it doesn't have to be either or?
Well, they start out with something that's real. The image they start out with is something that's real, but once I get my hand into it, it becomes something else. So it becomes something abstract, and in that sense, it may look like something different to you than what I've just said. It may not look like a landscape. It may not look like some sort of a map. It may look like forms and beautiful color. It may look like lots of things, which is one of the reasons I've worked abstractly, not to illustrate something and so that it's just about one thing, so that it can be about many different kinds of things.
So in some ways you're taking the means for which we try to understand reality and then you're abstracting from it again.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what does that allow you to do, I mean, when you're doing that?
Well, I think as an artist, it allows you incredible freedom to use your imagination and all of this information from a world I'm not really a part of. The scientific world is filtered through my own brain in this case, and with a lot of other sorts of information, and then becomes something else. So it's a transformation process. Hmm.
When you were when you work on these projects, it takes a long time. Mm-hmm. But we were talking earlier about how there's this need to have some kind of instant gratification, because you don't ever really. How long do these projects usually take you?
The embroideries I have more of a sense of because they're small. But people often are always trying to give me tips on how to work faster, or how to go to a machine and have something embroidered, which I have never done. So I actually don't count how long it takes. Oh. I also don't count how many little red discs are in there, because I think I'd start really wondering about myself if I started. Someone actually did make a count of a piece I'll show you later, which I found amazing. Part of the process of working where you're building up a kind of inventory is a meditative process for me. I don't do sketches of these pieces before I start. And during that process of making is the time when the piece really comes to the forefront and becomes what it's going to be. So part of the labor intensiveness is because of the way I make it. Part of it's very deliberate. It's a process during which I conceive of the piece beyond an initial kind of a spark.
And then the drawing, how does that figure into it? Oops. Oh, well, we could talk about this for the drawing.
Oh, I'll go back here.
Okay.
And then the... As Ryan was saying, they take a very long time, months and months and months. And I work on more than one at a time, and I also work on drawings, because although my drawings are also quite labor-intensive, they're really fast compared to these. So I feel like something's in front of me much quicker than I do something that takes months to draw. So I draw simultaneously with making a work, and the drawings... The drawings, which I'll show you a little later on, often generate something that becomes a sculptural piece, but not intentionally. They aren't made as something like a sketch, and then like a sketch of something, and then you go to a block of marble and carve it out. They're made as I'm working on other things.
And then when you started working with Ladue, that was also, did that introduce a new way of drawing for you, or... It seemed well.
Additional way of drawing. I exhausted the found images because there just aren't that many out there to find, and I happened to know someone very casually who works at this particular lab that I ended up being an artist in residence in, and I initially wanted to speak with Joe Ladue just about whether I could get some more images from the lab to use. And as it turns out, he's a very very global thinker as a scientist. And he's interested not only in having scientists in his lab, but he often invites people for noontime lunch talks just like this from all areas, lawyers, artists, social workers, doctors, from all different kinds of areas so that everyone can hear what's going on in their field and how it might pertain to his field. And so after we talked for a little while, he invited me to come into the lab. And I thought it might last a day or two, and it's now going on 2.5 years. So it's really been a fascinating sort of second studio for me to be there. And also a look at the fact that scientists and artists, I think, are much more alike than we generally believe. We're both after, I think, we both use our intuition a lot in different ways, but we both use intuition. We both, at least in my case, work slowly toward our goal. And we both are trying to make something that's intangible tangible. So I've found working with neuroscientists like sitting around with a lot of my artist colleagues and having fascinating discussions. One of the things that I've been doing there for a long time is drawing. And in this image, you see that I'm drawing in the dark through a microscope of a particular part of the brain that they're studying at the lab. It's called the amygdala, and it's where fear and anxiety reside. It's a very small, kind of almond-shaped part of the brain. And I'm drawing through a microscope, but you can see on the right there's kind of a horizontal lens sticking out. That's an additional lens called a camera lucida. And this is how scientists always draw when they're drawing, using this. So I'm actually watching my hand draw as I'm drawing. And because what I'm drawing is so tiny, that hand looking at what I'm drawing kind of helps me keep on track, because I'm drawing very small, small parts of the brain.
So if I can kind of try to clarify it for myself, so you're looking at a magnification of a brain, of brain's like cells, and then at the same time you're able to see your own hand drawing,
right.
So you don't have to lift up your head from...
Right, so I don't lift my head up.
I find that really very strange. Yeah. Because what happens is that you become not only... You're not only looking at something, but you're also conscious at how you're recording it at the same time.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's similar. In art school, one of the things you do is, when you're in your first year, is do contour drawings, where there's a model in front of you, and then you are to try and take your pencil and follow the contours of that figure without looking back at your paper. So it's an eye... hand coordination thing. This is a little different, but
yeah, and I guess for me, yeah. What's strange to me is that you're examining the brain while using your brain to examine the brain.
Exactly.
It becomes very strange. You know, I get a
and
little.
And it's very meditative. The first time I did this, I looked up and I'd been doing it for 2 hours without realizing how much time had passed. It's a fascinating way to draw, and on the also another. Interesting thing. You see, these are all boxes of slides above me on the shelves. Although the computer can do this very same thing that I'm drawing for the scientists, and they use this extensively, many scientists, including the head of this lab, Joseph Ledoux, still draw by hand because they feel the kind of information they can get by sitting the way I'm doing and looking at the brain is still different than what they get from the computer, that they get a different kind of information.
Yeah, I find that really interesting because I would think they would want to use photography, that somehow the machine is more objective than the hand.
Right.
And so I think that comes up a lot with your work too, this idea of what's objective and what's not, and where does the expressivity come in. When we start to talk about your project at the Smithsonian, it's interesting because you do in some ways think of setting up a lab in each of these places that you do research.
Yeah. And here, you know, I'm in a science lab, so I can't bring in my huge tables and all of my stuff that I keep around me in my own studio. I had to be quite brief, and so I devised sort of a little case, which is what I brought to the Smithsonian, too, so that I could be an artist in residence, but also not be too intrusive with what else was going on there.
So when you started working with the... American history. Oh, this is. These are some of the images, right?
Yeah, these are some of the images from this particular lab that I've been working with. Not necessarily that I was drawing, but just to give you an idea of what it looks like when you start going down into your brain on these different levels. I think they're gorgeous, and they also have a lot of information in them, and they're colorized for the same reasons I said before, so that you can see different kinds of information.
So a scientist is making aesthetic choices. It's like, okay, I like this color green because it...
No, it's not really an aesthetic choice. It's a choice that a certain kind of chemical introduced will make a certain color.
Okay.
And that way you can... But they happen to be beautiful in my mind.
Interesting.
So here is an example of one of the drawings that I was doing behind that microscope.
So when you're focused on the body, I wonder if you saw yourself sitting
Well, I came of age as an artist during the first wave of feminism, so I was definitely influenced by that. And I also came to New York during the first wave of feminism, when there was a group called the Guerrilla Girls who were rocking around, if some of you are familiar with them, putting up posters in Soho where all the galleries were, and reminding people in very funny and interesting ways that there weren't many women in the art world showing in galleries and museums, et cetera, et cetera. So that was a huge influence because it was at a really big juncture in my art career. And I have always thought of myself as a feminist. I feel like I'm an artist. I have never done feminist work per se, although you're right, all those things definitely track into very domestic feminine things.
Is the world of brain research, is it still kind of male dominated, or
I don't know across the board, but in the lab where I'm working, it's about equal men and women.
Great.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
Do the functions of the specific brain parts you're working with influence how your drawing goes? Like, say, you're working with an anger section or, a communication section. Does that manifest itself?
Well, probably only on the level that I, since I've been looking at the brain for a long time, I know all of those things about how it works, but not consciously. I'd say on an unconscious level.
So that's interesting, though, because if you're working for a particular brain, a part of a brain, and you know what that part does, but it doesn't influence how you draw it.
Well, it does on an unconscious level.
Oh, okay.
And also, I might add that the brain, although there's this tremendous amount of research being done on it, it's still the least known part of our bodies, with a big L. Yes.
Go ahead.
I don't know the answer to that yet because it's a beginning series and I have about 20 of them now, and at this point they're being shown on a table so that you can look down into them, but that may change.
I mean, what's I think also too, just that this is part of a longer process.
It's part of a longer process, and I think I need more inventory, so to speak, before I make that kind of decision. Because they could go on the wall, too.
Anybody else? Any other questions? Uh-huh. Herman?
You were working with a scientist, and you start off with matters which are very scientific. And you show the work that you have done to them. Is there any interaction which impresses?
That's a great question. I've shown some of it to them, and we have great discussions. And going back to what I said about abstract work before, one of the things that's most rewarding to me in those discussions is how many other things they see in the work that maybe I was thinking of on some level, but not that I would say outright. And so they bring a lot to the discussion. It's really fascinating.
Are you having them see their work differently by looking at your artwork?
They think so.
And what kinds of things do they say? If you
can
recall.
They just think they're thinking differently. I think more metaphorically might be one way they might say.
Oh. Okay. Anybody else? Well, thank you very much. This is really interesting. And just a brief announcement about the next In Conversation, which will be happening next week on Friday at 12:30. It will be Zoe Charlton, D.C. area artist, speaking to Gada Amir, Egypt-born, New York-based artist. And it will be the same format that we've been using today, so hopefully you'll join us. Thank you very much. She's also an artist research fellow recipient. So thank you very much for coming.
So the last three or four images are of what's coming out of this now, and I emphasize coming out because it's at the very beginning stages. I think it's a whole digestive process when you're able to do something like go into the Smithsonian Museum and have curators let you just go down and look into the bowels of the museum and see things that you'd never see and actually have them taken out and come up. And my studio ended up being various offices of people who were gone for the week, and I had my case and went in there with beautiful light and drew. So I learned a lot of things from this experience, but a lot of it's still being digested. And what's coming out of it are two, at this point in time, two related bodies of work. One is a work on paper, and these vary from quite small to 30 by 40 inches, which is fairly large. There's cyanotypes, which is a photographic process, an early photographic process that was used by botanists to go out in the field and take a fern, put it on chemically coated paper, and then expose it to the sun, wash it in water, and have a print of what they had seen. And so I've been using this process, which is very low tech, from another time, and I've been layering this information that I've been talking about and collaging over the top of it. So it's combinations of drawings I've done at the Smithsonian, photographs, lab drawings, and my imagination, of course, that are producing this kind of imagery.
It's interesting because one of the things that comes up for me is you're using technology, but the final results, but what you're doing with it is you're warming it up. I mean, I see that if you were just using photographic techniques based on what's going on with the machinery that's used there, it would be one thing, but you're also putting your hand back into it. And I guess,
right.
So I'm really curious about why is it important for you to do that? It might be hard to answer.
I get asked this all the time because there's so much going on in the art world now that is not about handmade things. And there is handmade, of course, but there's a whole other way of making art that doesn't involve the hand. I think I'm like Joe Ledoux in the sense that I still feel that the hand is important, despite the fact I use computers, I use digital technology. I still feel that the way we know in the world, in some sense, is still informed by touch, and that a hand doing something can't be done in any other way, in one sense. So I still feel it's a very crucial part of ourselves and a way that we're all used to knowing information about the world.
Because it seems science is going more and more towards brain research and being interested in the brain, and kind of like it's a territory that they want to work out. And here you're bringing the hand back to it. I find maybe it's in some ways looking for some kind of balance with that. Because we also were talking about the idea of making these kind of more gestural or emotional, what we might say are emotional marks with these things that we usually think of as more colder and informational. So when you're drawing, how is it feeling differently than when you're recording, I guess is the...
Well, when you're, I'm just...
I guess I'm actually interpreting your work in the question, okay. And I'm sorry about that.
Okay.
But I guess that I get a sense that you're processing the experience.
Right.
Through the drawing?
It's like if you're thinking of... swallowing some water when you're taking a drink, it goes through it's like a digestive process. That's one way of thinking about it. And I think another interesting thing that actually is not my idea but came from the neuroscience lab was the fact that science is often seen by the general public as being really dry, impossible to understand, not beautiful, not exciting, except for scientists, except for, a small portion of the population. And Joe Ledoux and I had a conversation one time when he was talking about he's just so intent on the public seeing how exciting science is, how emotional. I mean, these people get really excited about these things, and they study emotion. They're interested in emotion on one level that's scientific, but they're also very excited about what they're doing, and they want people to know about that and about the beauty about, that's inherent in what they're doing, as well as mm-hmm. the kind of other information.
It's interesting, because I was just thinking when you were speaking, like, are you a scientist or are you an artist? I mean,
definitely
how do we...
not a scientist.
So you know yourself as not being a scientist, and yet you're still working in this environment and feel comfortable with them. And the information is there, but it's interesting, you're almost kind of serving another function of bringing this information into the public. What made you decide to start working with more scientific content?
Well, if my interest in the body, there's no other way to start looking where I wanted to look uh-huh. other than going to science.
Uh-huh. It's, okay.
And I also have to say I was a horrible science student in high school and grade school. And so this is, it's sort of like, you know, one section is just going back to school and finding out all these amazing things, because it's so easy to understand once someone presents it to you like they would present anything else in just a, you know, conversational way.
Yeah. I mean, you also...
not all of it. I mean, it's definitely...
But you also talk a lot about beauty, too. I've heard you use the words sensuous and beautiful a lot. And so your connection to this is that it's beautiful for you.
It's also, I find it very beautiful to look at what's inside the self and look at it in a way that kind of goes beyond that squeamish, ooh, the, you know, the gray matter of the brain. And there's so many different ways of looking at it.
And that actually happened to me.
And it actually happened to Ryan.
While
he was looking at a papier-mâché model, he got squeamish.
I got squeamish because he's like, oh, here's a brain. It's like, I'm immediately taking it literally, and now you're going to open a door to it. It's like, ah. But actually, once they opened it, once they opened this model, the intricacy is the same kind of complexity you might have looking at a piece of art. So I really began to understand the excitement that you were feeling about looking at these models and translating them to your work. And with this work here...
So the last two images are the second theme that I've been working with is more sculptural. And these, so far this has taken the form of using glass Petri dishes like you use in the lab of various sizes. And in these, I'm literally layering information from my lab drawings, from the Smithsonian drawings, from nature, because there's a lot of parallels between... the way the brain works and the way the brain looks, and natural phenomena. And I'm using it with fabric. I'm using it with all kinds of different materials. On the top, which is really difficult to see, but over the leaf, you can see a little bit of, I'm etching in the glass, which is a way of drawing into the glass.
Do people see what she's talking about when she says the leaf?
Yeah, where the it's a darker. Section is, which is a leaf, and you can see a little bit of the etching on the top layer of the glass. And the last image here is another in that series of Petri dishes with the information layered and layered and layered and layered, sometimes 10 or 15 different layers of information, and then the top etched with a drawing.
And those are layers of what were the glass? I'm sorry.
Layers of glass, layers of fabric, layers of paper, layers of thread. It takes many, many different forms.
Interesting. So here's a chance to ask any questions of Neen and her work. Okay, go ahead.
Amygdala?
Amygdala, uh-huh.
Is that A-M-I-G?
A-M. I'm a terrible speller, too. A-M-Y-G. D-A-L-A, I think.
D-A-L-A. Uh-huh. Where is that?
That is right back here. It's a very primitive part of the brain. It looks like an almond, and amygdala means almond.
And, compared to a real almond, how large is it?
It's smaller than an almond, but not a lot.
It's interesting that we're asking a scientific question from an artist. Just thought that was interesting.
Thank God I happen to know, right?
Go ahead. Okay.
Do you follow
this
strategy of using craft materials and techniques?
Is that in focus there? I can't tell.
Yeah, it seems like it's
They're made with a corsage pin and then a strip of silk wound around it. My studio for a long time was in the Garment Center in New York, and I ended up using a lot of materials that were in that area. And I also grew up with a mother and grandmother that did a lot of sewing, so that's part of my background too. And I find fabric as a material to work with sculpturally very interesting because it's so malleable. It's, again, very very sensual and has beautiful color. I began to dye this almost like a painter would pick different tubes of paint to get the kind of color palette that I wanted to.
And these are, and it also looks like there's pencil marks on the wall?
The pencil marks are on the wall generated after the piece is finished. They're a kind of mapping so that if this is sent on to some place where I can't go to install it, there are directions and someone else can literally put up the piece by themselves. But I often do use kind of mapping marks in these pieces as well.
Great. So this begins our discussion of what you were doing at the Museum of American History,
right.
And your artist research fellowship, and these are the Ozu atomical models.
Right. So when I was asked to come to the Smithsonian on the fellowship that Ryan spoke about earlier. I was in contact with two of the curators, Ray Kondratis and Judy Chelnick, who are in science and medicine. And I initially came with the idea of simply wanting to explore that collection in a very, very broad way, and in a way that dealt with pre-21st century, because I was working already in a lab where I was with state-of-the-art equipment and research that's being done on the brain right now. And I wanted to just kind of wander back a little bit in history and explore those things. What I found here that was the most interesting after very little time looking at the collection was these models that a doctor named Ozu did in the 19th century. And they're papier-mâché models of the human body that are absolutely incredibly beautiful, anatomically correct, and replace those wax models that I showed you in the very beginning of the talk. The wax models were expensive. They were, you know, easy to nick if you think about the properties of wax, and also melting was always an issue. And Ozu, puppetry was very popular in Europe at this point in time, and Ozu used the models, the way of making papier-mâché from puppetry and translated that into a way of working with the brain. And this is the brain that I almost exclusively focused on this for the 8 or 9 weeks that I was at the Smithsonian. Because as you can see, the brain comes entirely apart. It's all beautifully made with little hinges and hooks, and you can start undoing it bit by bit by bit to get into the interior. So this was just a fascinating, beautiful object for me. And there are many other beautiful things that he made that are in the collection, but I stayed with this and I drew it. I made hundreds of drawings of it, and I also photographed it.
Now, when you're working from these models, and since you've worked in a contemporary lab, what do you learn about that time period just from how they're making the models of the body? Or what do you get from that?
Well, there's a lot of things to think about when you're looking back in time. One of them was just the way of introducing this material to people. And in this case, instead of a slide or an image like I was showing you from the brain that you would take from a microscope or, say, an X-ray image, there's a physicality to this. It's an actual object in front of you, and it's annotated. There's right. French phrases throughout the whole thing sort of explaining what you're looking at, or sometimes little fingers pointing in the direction of where the hinge and the lock is to give you a clue how to open it up to the next level. And also they could not go any further than this particular thing goes. So you're seeing
what
everything
they could,
that was available.
So we're kind of seeing what they can see.
What they can see, exactly.
When you were working with these, did it change? Like, because you'd already been working from, you know, with the brain, and then now you're working with this, does it does it somehow change the way you're looking, or does it give you new ideas, or what did it do for your process?
Well, I mentioned earlier that I work really slowly as a rule, and I'm working on this, and I have some images of what I'm working on, and I think what's come out of it is a sort of layering idea, and that has to do with the way information is layered sometimes just in our everyday lives. It's not black, it's not white. There's a lot of layers to the way we know things. And this is a way that contemporary scientists work when they're looking also in a very layered way down into the body. So I think, here's another image from the Ozu brain taken apart. I think what happened was that I'm in some ways taking material from this project and taking material from the neuroscience project and putting them together in my own mind.
And when people would look at these images, I mean, how important is it for them to know their source? I mean, I guess I'm trying to...
Well, sometimes their clues with the title of the work might have a clue that refers to the brain, which mine at this point in time often does. Sometimes it'll have a clue about the fact of where it came from. Sometimes it's obvious that it's microscopic. It depends on the particular works. Mm-hmm. So I use titles, but I don't want to tell everyone the full story, and they don't need to know it to appreciate the work. So again, my process at the Smithsonian was beginning to draw in a very straightforward, literal way what I was looking at. And gradually, the drawings became more and more abstract as I was looking at the same object. So these are some examples of what happened to that fairly realistic drawing at the beginning as it went through time and I was looking at the brain. And it's actually what I saw. It's not abstracted, or this is actually what I was looking at in the microscope. And then here are some drawn images, which we were talking about before. These are about 30 by 40 inches, the drawing. And they begin with one of those same images that I just showed you underneath a piece of vellum, which is a kind of translucent drawing paper. And I work over that, beginning by almost copying what I'm seeing underneath. And then it takes off in its own direction and gets moved around, and a different kind of drawing is generated through my imagination.
See, that was interesting, because I was just thinking, like, why would you make a distinction between the drawing you're doing with the under the microscope? Or it's not a microscope, but it's a... why would you make a distinction between the lab drawings and then the ones that these ones? But you're saying that your imagination starts to set in.
Right, and it's sort of like I've said to people at the Smithsonian, it's like being a hunter-gatherer at first. You're in a whole new territory, and you're trying to discover, and you're trying to learn. And so in the beginning, the kind of process you're going through is really a different way of looking than once you get into your own head.
Mm-hmm.
So these drawings, as I said earlier, often do generate very large pieces. This is 10 feet high by 15 feet long, and it's on the wall. I'll show you a detail in a minute. And this was counted by someone at a museum, so I actually know there are 2,000 plus pieces in this particular work. It was generated by the drawing I showed you before that and by the work I've been talking about. And the title is Every Force Evolves a Form, which for me is a title that evokes a lot of what happens inside of our bodies, where there's so much energy and electrical stuff going on and movement. So it's, even though we're sitting here still, there's this incredible amount of force going on inside of us, which interests me.